Thank you so much, Rufus, for being with me today on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. You're my 77th guest. How are you today, Rufus?
Oh, thanks for having me, Garrett. I'm doing just fine. Dog days of summer here, and it's a crazy time to do what I do, having lived through the American political system. So trying to have a little bit of peace of mind in these days, but which is a challenge, but I'm doing just fine.
Well, that's great to hear. And I know that, you know, with any administration change, there is some consternation and frustration, and I'm sure we'll get into all of that. You were the 34th chief of protocol under President Biden's administration. You are a direct descendant of John Brown, who helped found the Ivy League Brown University. Very impressive. And then we found out that we have a connection with the Andrea Doria. My mom and her side of the family were scheduled to be on that ship. And thankfully, they missed the departure time and they went on another ship less than 2 weeks later. But I found out through my research that your father and his side of the family survived the sinking. Unfortunately, for my wife's side of the family, she has a family member on her late grandmother's side who had tragically passed away from that sinking. But it's not something you typically hear. I mean, that was a defining moment in maritime, you know, shipping as far as that goes, or in terms of, you know, immigrants coming from all different parts of the world, especially Europe, to the United States. So we could talk about that too. But when you think of relationship building in a team environment, Rufus, what does relationship building mean to you? And what has it meant for your professional career?
Well, so for me, relationships and human relationships are actually, in some ways, that they are what separate man from beast. In essence, the ability to emote, to look someone in the eye, everything from handshakes and eye contact and whatnot, that legit human connection, which is different, which is honestly what perhaps maybe the most important thing, in addition to, of course, our highly evolved brains, but our ability to build communities in the way that we do them and build societies in the way that we do them is unique to humanity. And so for me, human relationships and the connection between individual humans and peoples, meaning communities of people, is enormously important. And I think at this time where there's growing disconnection between people based on, you know, for all good reasons, I'm a huge believer in technology and taking a big step forward and taking those big technological step forwards. But we also have to acknowledge that with that degree of ease, meaning everything is at your fingertips now, that human relationships often are sacrificed. And you're certainly seeing this in greater numbers in younger generations. COVID, of course, was a massive accelerator of some of that just isolation and lack of human interaction, which of course is connected to everything from love and friendship and sexual relationships and all of the kind of emotion, again, that is connected to humanity. So for me, so on the human side, on the personal side, I think those relationships matter so, so much. But also on the professional side, I mean, in the two kind of modes, so I've been an ambassador, Senate confirmed ambassador twice. I was the U.S. ambassador to Denmark under Obama.
That is correct.
And then chief of protocol. And then, in addition to that, I've done 6 presidential campaigns. I count 2024 as 2 because it was almost like 2. And both of those, and all of the jobs that I had, investing in human relationships as an effort to build trust were vital, and with differing degrees of success. I mean, both Obama campaigns, for example, I think were extraordinarily successful in delivering a message that was tangible and inspiring to people, and that was extremely important. My ambassadorship to Denmark was really actually driven by that concept too. I almost wanted to think through the successes that I had had in politics, not anything having to do with the actual politics, but thinking through how to best connect and try to bring that to the world of diplomacy. Because so much of what, you know, I was focusing on was during this time of an inherent distrust of institutions and pillars of power, what I represented, you know, the United States government, there was so much skepticism about it. And so for me to try to add a human touch there, to try to tear down some of those walls, was a huge part of my project when I was ambassador. And that led to everything from me agreeing to do a kind of a reality show about the life and times of an ambassador, which was enormously popular both in Denmark, but then was sold to Netflix and aired all over the world. And there was something so interesting about that experiment because you realize that actually, if you do invest in those human relationships and those connections between people, you can actually make a real impact. And that's how I, that's, and that's what we saw. That's what we saw when I was ambassador. It was that I was able to make those human connections, which allowed me to do my job better. I was more effective for as a United States representative because I had earned the trust of Danes in that moment, in those moments, and that mattered. And the chief of protocol is all about trust, in essence. It's all about the handshake. It's all about the deal. It's all about making people feel good. And it's all about in person. It's it can only the job is only relevant in person. The virtual world and protocol don't really go very well together.
Sure, I can understand and appreciate that. I mean, just coming from you, having experience in both roles, being the 62nd US ambassador to Denmark and then being the 34th chief of protocol, and having served under President Obama and then President Biden, and President Biden being President Obama's vice president, when you were serving both roles, how much of there was similarities or were similarities rather and differences serving under both administrations?
The nuance in between the administrations, you mean
Yes.
different? I think they were different, and it's interesting because, of course, as you said, Biden was in the Obama administration, but I think an administration really reflects the CEO, meaning really reflects the leader at the time, and I think there was doubt, especially at the beginning of the Obama administration. I think it evolved into something that felt a little bit more mainstream. But at the beginning of the Obama administration, there was something very kind of revolutionary about it. And I don't mean in the policies, but I mean in like the youth coming into the White House and younger people, more diverse voices. I mean, one of the reasons why I was appointed to be an ambassador in the second term, which is obviously that the role of diversity has completely changed in the last few months, of course. But one of them is because I was an openly gay man. And there had only been, I think, one or two openly gay men serving as the time I was nominated to be an ambassador. So it was this kind of new people, fresh voices, different voices. There was a youth, a positivity. He wasn't yet, he was what, 47, which is 4 years younger than I am now, which is amazing. When he was elected president, I think he was 47, something like that. So that was that, right? That was that moment in time. The Biden administration was much more exactly kind of how President Biden is. It was much more establishment feeling. It was older. It was a lot more kind of grounded in institution in some of the institutions. It was more, most of what I've described about the Obama was administration was positive, and I do feel very positively about the Obama administration. But there was also a naivete about the Obama administration because it was so new. They didn't know how to work that the Hill as well. They didn't know they made some like larger mistakes early on, and some of the stuff most people wouldn't remember just because there was it no, it's very hard to be prepared to be president. No one understands that, and the people coming in don't. Whereas the Biden administration, I don't think made that those kinds of mistakes because there probably are very few presidents who are ever more prepared to be president than President Biden. And the people coming in many ways, had served in very high level roles inside the White House at one time or another. So, but I do think there wasn't the freshness at all, and that was harder. There wasn't the sophisticated communication. There wasn't the ability to deliver a message, in the same way the Obama administration was. That being said, they knew how to work the Hill. They knew how to get bills passed. And that's obviously the legislator in Joe Biden was, I think, very clear. And that was different than under the Obama administration in my mind. So, there are nuances in style and in substance, as far as I'm concerned.
It's interesting you would say that because I would agree with you. And if you were to combine President Obama's administrations with President Biden's administration, having served just one term, I think it would be, virtually like the perfect administration because you point out, like during the Obama years, bringing that youth, bringing that diversity, younger people's voices, but in a sense, having that lacking in terms of how the Hill works and how to navigate through the various channels, working with Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and even getting the Affordable Care Act through was a Herculean effort. And thank goodness it got through. But just the rollout of Obamacare. I remember at the time with Kathleen Sebelius, and just again, it was challenging, but
The website broke and stuff like that. That's what you mean, right?
that was more, mechanical, right? But the intention and the substance of what Obamacare was right from the start was so needed when so many millions of people across the country were without health care. But I point to that as an example because when President Biden got into office, to your point, he understood the Hill, 50 years of understanding how Capitol Hill works and obviously how foreign diplomacy works. But from a communications apparatus, standpoint, perhaps not as robust or not as, visible as in the Obama years. So if you mirror both, or if you combine both together, the communication and the robust apparatus with the Hill experience, and being that they're both presidents and one served as the other's vice president, it is interesting how there was not so much, full continuity. You did have some holdovers from the Obama years. Once they got through Trump's first term, they came back to work under President Biden. But having, in your case, having worked for both men, you're somebody who would know very well the similarities and differences.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're two very, I think one of the reasons why the Obama administration worked quite well is because the President Biden, then Vice President Biden, was such a trusted advisor. I mean, you pick someone, when you pick an effective vice president, they're a compliment to you. He or she is a compliment to you. And I think, and then Senator Biden was selected to be then Senator Obama's running mate because Joe Biden had that kind of gravitas, especially on the foreign policy stage, that Barack Obama at the time did not have. And so I think President Biden, that really helped him there. I say all that by way of saying that they were very different people. They still are very different people, and different men, different leaders, with the same, I mean, largely the same ideology, but certainly different styles and different, slightly different perspectives about Washington and how you govern. But that's kind of a that's sort of fun, and that's why people honestly write history books about the various personalities of the various presidents. And obviously, we have one now that is completely different from what previous presidents have been like.
Sure. And when you think of both roles as chief of protocol and U.S. ambassador to Denmark, do you feel that one was more of a natural fit than the other, even though that you excelled in both? What was the mindset you had going into both roles? And, it's all about relationship building. So to be a U.S. ambassador to another country and to be the chief of protocol, I interviewed the 31st chief of protocol under President Obama. You would know him well, Peter Selfridge. And so I'm honored to interview another former chief of protocol to have on my podcast. But, whether it's you, Peter, Adrian, Sheila Nix, I mean, Adrian Elrod, Arshi Siddiqui, who worked for Nancy Pelosi when she was, U.S. Speaker of the House, I'm very prideful of the fact that I have, top Democrats who have, whether they've worked for President Obama, President Biden, or when President Biden was vice president, Hillary Clinton, when Adrian was helping her on her campaign. Peter worked for the Obama administration, but reported to Secretary of State John Kerry, a gentleman who I've met before. And when I think of, Arshi Siddiqui, I mean, having to be Nancy Pelosi's, former senior policy advisor and counsel when, Speaker Pelosi was first Speaker of the House. So when I think of just all the people I've interviewed in the Democratic Party so far, I just love that there's a lot of overlap and that although you have your individual styles or ways of, probably processing or working through all the minutiae of everyday, life in the political world, you all have this, relationship building amongst you and you know each other so well, or I've heard of each other through just other relationships. And I just like that so far, the guests I've had in the political world have pretty much worked for the same three or four people, give or take how big or small their roles have been. So I just love from a relationship building perspective that I can, draw on those examples. And you and Adrian formed the Elrod Gifford group earlier this year. Would love to talk about that and, just how you got your career started and what made you want to pursue a life in politics.
Well, I think your first question was sort of how did I think about preparing for the ambassadorship versus the job of chief of protocol of the US. I think the ambassadorship was definitely something that was a very kind of heady experience for me. I was at the time I was 38 years old. I was a political staffer. I was just coming off the Obama re-election campaign. So to be what they call extraordinary and plenipotentiary, that's what they give the titles, which is just means extraordinarily and all is extraordinary and all powerful in this job in the capital of one of our best allies in Copenhagen. And that was very intense for the 38-year-old, gay political staffer who never dreamed he'd be in rooms with presidents and queens and things like that. And so that was, I really needed to lean. I felt very unprepared going into, I shouldn't say it that way. I was as prepared as I needed to be. I had spent months, the process of getting Senate confirmed takes, 6 months. So you spend a lot of time talking to people inside the State Department and the Pentagon and all the agencies that work with on our bilateral relationship. But it's still, I'm a firm believer that you don't know how to do a job until you start to do it. And so it wasn't until I arrived in Denmark in August of 2013 that I really tried to figure all this out. And there you are again. I was younger than the vast majority of the rest of the folks at the embassy, and working with everything from the intelligence services and the military, and of course the Danish government, the prime minister, meeting the queen. All of this is, and what I really tried to do was, well, one, embrace it, jump head first, and put my heart in it in every way, but also lean on the professionals that are there. I mean, lean on the Americans and the Danes that have been doing this work at the embassy and who are extraordinary men and women and made me incredibly smart. And that combination of jumping in, kind of pushing them to take risks in some ways because of who I was, but also really trying to lean on their expertise, that allowed me to have the success that I had in Denmark. As for chief of protocol, it was a slightly different experience. I felt the Senate confirmation process took forever on that too. I felt that my skill set was perfectly suited for parts of that job and not necessarily all that well suited for different parts of that job, meaning the human part, the building, being the face of the country or the face of America when they're the leaders are landing at Andrews or wherever. That part in building a relationship with the diplomatic corps in Washington, that felt very natural to me, and I enjoyed that very much. Some of the parts of the job associated with being like a social secretary or an advance person, which is certainly part of the job as well, that's not my skill set. I'm not the details guy in the same way someone else might be. And so I certainly had a lot to learn as it relates to some of the kind of the granularity of protocol, which it's never been my interest necessarily. So it was, but life is about these extraordinary experiences. And as chief of protocol, you fly around the world with the president of the United States and meet every leader. I mean, I think I literally, considering all the summits we hosted, I think I have met every world leader minus Kim Jong-un and Putin. So, and I wasn't sad about either of the not meeting either of them. So I think it's so everyone from Zelensky and Modi and all at the time, Macron and Trudeau and all the rest. I mean, it was that part is fascinating. But it was, I am someone who just loves these kinds of experiences and loves seeing the world and meeting the people who are running the world and being part of that. So that was wonderful as well. You asked me how I got into it. I think it's, I grew up in Boston. My dad was a banker. I grew up outside Boston, I should say. I went to Brown University and I moved and but when I graduated, I just because I wanted to be my own man and not in the shadow of my dad and my family, I wanted to move to LA and do something totally different, which is work in the entertainment industry. So I spent a few years after Brown working for a producer, and that was fine, but I was not particularly inspired, in all honesty. So I quit my job in 2004 and being a Massachusetts boy, I had gone to college with one of John Kerry's daughters, who was a great friend of mine. She said, "Why don't you quit your job and come volunteer on the 2004 campaign for my dad?" So, I did that. I quit my job, asked my mom and dad to support me for 6 months until the election, in hopes that, we would win and I'd go to DC maybe and get a job. But I was hired within a couple of weeks. That volunteer job turned into a real job on the campaign. That was my first job in politics, and I never looked back from that. We are people, meaning humans. I think we're on the constant search for purpose. It's one of the most important words in the English language to me. And how do you find your purpose? The way I define it is, for the first time in my life, and I was right around the time I turned 30 when I started with Carrie, I was a balancing of my head and my heart. Meaning I was doing something I was passionate about, but I was also good at it. And that was the first time I'd experienced that. There are other times where I'd either done something that I thought I was passionate about, but I just wasn't that good at it, or I wasn't as good as I wanted to be. Or there were times where I was good at something, but I didn't really like it. And here was this moment where I did both. And that's what makes you want to get out of bed in the morning. And that's what makes you really, really understand what life is all about. And I mean, at least in the professional side. And that was magic to me. So then I started my own business after Kerry lost, as a political consultant, and met Obama in January 07. And never looked back. Did the first campaign from California, but worked for Obama in different capacities for 10 years, from January 07 to January 17.
That's quite a story. That's really amazing. And it's interesting because when I'm a little bit younger than you. I'm 37. Well, you speak about how like you being in your 30s and you got your start, but I'm, a few years away from 40. But I started my, career as an intern on Capitol Hill for a U.S. congressman from North Carolina, Brad Miller, who was in, had served for the 13th district before gerrymandering. And I really enjoyed that with a fellow Tar Heel, being a graduate of the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And President Obama, then senator, right up until just several months before he became president, when he won his 2008 campaign, Chapel Hill was one of the campaign stops, and he spoke after I took my last final exam for my sophomore year. And I went to the Dean E. Smith Center, where the UNC men's basketball team, plays all its home games. And President Obama, being a big Michael Jordan fan and being a big Tar Heel fan, I just remember him giving such a great, inspiring speech, and then, why he wanted to run and why he believed he was the right person for that time. And it was my first time and only time seeing President Obama, or then Senator Obama, in person. And then with John Kerry, this would have been after he had lost a 2004 election to President Bush. But one of John Kerry's relatives, I believe it was his niece, she and I had a class together. So when, well, at the time, Senator Kerry had come to UNC's campus to make a speech, and I listened to it, and I met him, and such a nice man. Very good to meet him. That would have been around the time that you actually, would have already had worked for him, and then slowly but surely, getting situated with working for Senator Obama, and then preparing him for his presidency, leading up to his inauguration. So yeah, I see some parallels, obviously, or some synergies. And it is interesting when you think back to a time of some of the people you crossed paths with. But I have always liked politics. After I interned on the Hill, I worked for ESPN and NBC Universal when I was a student at Georgetown University. During the summer before my senior year, before I finished up at Chapel Hill, I interned for the CBS affiliate television station in DC. But just being, on Georgetown's campus and getting to see the Capitol, the White House, and then when I interned on the Hill, I was also giving tours on the Hill. It was just a special time. And in my later, in recent years, I've developed an interest in public policy, and I've been interviewed on, digital, local, national networks talking about public policy, finance, and diplomacy abroad, and domestic issues here at home. And coming from the investment banking world, the previous 8+ years up until a few years ago, when my wife and I welcomed our first child, our son Peter. But I look at my experiences and I say, that's what makes a full life, when you can say you've done a lot of things. And in your point, the people you've worked with, the roles that you've held, it's all about the relationships, and it's all about, how you can draw from previous experience of people you may have crossed paths with, because you never know at some point down the road when you might be working with these people or for these people, or if there's an opportunity to collaborate. So I really, find that to be fascinating, that you were in the right place at the right time, getting to be introduced to, then Senator Obama, and then he had one of the greatest presidencies in U.S. history. And then I just want to also talk to you about your friendship with Adrian and how that started and why you wanted to form your group.
I mean, I want to just on the like oftentimes people ask me advice as to How do you get to be where you have gotten, and how do you have a career like you've had? And it's obviously a hard work, but it's a lot of luck too. I mean, the right place at the right time thing is real. But I'm also a firm believer in another expression, which is you create your own luck. Meaning, if you put yourself out there, you're bound to get lucky from time to time. How you don't get lucky is don't not taking risks. So, you never know. And this is your point. I first met Kamala Harris in 2005, I think it was, and having lunch at a little diner in LA where she was district attorney of San Francisco at the time. And she was trying to hire my firm that my business partner and I to help her build relationships in Los Angeles. Like, who would have known she was just a few votes short of becoming president of the United States? And those are the kinds of things. And I'd known her, not close, but obviously became closer in the last couple of years. But it's those kinds of relationships. Don't ever take them, don't ever write people off. Don't ever count people out. And I've been counted out before, because they will come back and they will have power, but and they could be, obviously, if they're a bad person, that's different. But the number of times people have written either or underestimated some me or someone I know who's then gone on to do great things, I could count on certainly more than two hands. And that's, I don't have any regrets about that. That's fine. It's only motivated me, but it is very important. So the one thing I say when people ask me for my advice, I say, work your tail off and be nice to people. And that's essentially my mantra. And in DC, and I've lived and worked in DC for a lot of my life, it's hard to it's that that's a it's a rough town. It's a very, very difficult town, but I've been able to navigate it by living with those by doing those two things. So Elrod and I, we didn't really know each other before the 2020 campaign, actually knew of each other. But I was always kind of on the Obama side. She was always on the Clinton side. And it was but in 2020 we started working together. But we almost never met, because if you remember, that campaign was virtual, and both of us had came on in the general after everything was shut down, but we talked all the time. I actually never met, I don't know that I ever met Adrian Elrod in person until election night of 2020, when we went to Philadelphia for the election. And we just stayed friends after we won, and through the Biden administration. We didn't work together during the Biden administration directly until she came on board the election, a good close to a year after I did, because she was at the Department of Commerce. And but we always felt, and then we worked very closely together in 24 as well. But we always felt that we had sort of similar styles, but complementing skill sets, meaning we both are who we are, meaning we're both kind of very out there. We're both fairly public. We both like that. We both are relationship people, meaning we're kind of both known. I mean, I'm known in politics as a fundraiser. She's known in politics as being kind of the comms and celebrity guru, both of which lead to having extraordinary Rolodexes. So, our Rolodexes are very good. We do different things, meaning she is sort of in the comm space, and I'm more on the sort of business leader, CEO, funder space, but we work together very well. So we thought that would be interesting to see if we could partner at this moment, when we're thinking about how to take, one, the Democratic Party, but also even just sort of whether you are an individual, an organization, a nonprofit, or even a private entity, and help them navigate this moment, both on the federal side as well as the state side, the state and local side. And I think we're quite well situated there. We're quite well poised to help, whether it's an organization, a nonprofit, or a business, do that. And so that's what we did. That's what we decided to do. And I think, as everyone needs after a grueling election cycle, in 2024 was grueling in every way. I needed to take a little bit of a break, and so kind of have eased into to this. But it's going great. It's going great, and we're very excited about what's to come. Because every people, a lot of folks, after you lose and you see what's happening to the country, it's really easy to want to bury your head in the sand and quit. But we simply can't quit, and we simply can't bury our head in the sand. So it feels good to be out there again.
Of course. And, with, as you pointed out, I mean, Vice President Harris, now former Vice President Harris, she just recently announced that she'll not be running for the governorship of California. But, you know, it begs the question, you know, what her next move is. And I'm sure, because she's been an extraordinary public servant and, you know, has done so much for her home state of California, and, you know, what she accomplished as U.S. Senator, district attorney, and, you know, she's done an extraordinary job. And I just hope that she finds the right role. And if she wants to run for president in 2028, that would be amazing. I know that Governor Newsom, you know, just from what you could gather, you know, with all the public discussions going on and just what you read online, I mean, he's probably going to be a strong contender as well. But then you have a whole field of Democrats from Wes Moore to, you know, J.B. Pritzker, Jared Polis, Gretchen Whitmer, Josh Shapiro. I mean, there are so many Democrats, and maybe even some we haven't even discussed yet, or who are not, you know, really thought about on a day-to-day basis. But I feel that, you know, with respect to your group that you formed with Adrian, she worked for President Clinton, and, you know, where she spent a lot of time with the Clintons, you spent a lot of time with President Obama and President Biden, but that there's the overlap as well, because she recently was this senior spokeswoman for both Biden for president, Harris for president. And it's, in my opinion, with your firm, because of your distinct but also overlapping experiences, I feel that you'll be able to, when putting forth messaging and working with different organizations and helping either, to your point, whether it's nonprofits or people who are looking to run campaigns and, you know, they need that communications strategy, you know, crisis communications expertise, you know, how to, you know, position themselves even with fundraising, something I know well, just from an investment banking standpoint, being a capital raiser for, yeah, as a consultant representing clients in 12 different industries and helping raise money for them, you know, small businesses and whatnot, and, you know, people who have been trying to get their entrepreneurial endeavors off the ground. So I have that experience. So I can appreciate, you know, what you and Adrian are trying to do from a fundraising standpoint, communications strategist standpoints. But it seems like you two are a small part of the pie of an overall, you know, pie of how to be able to communicate these democratic policies and the democratic values, and, you know, going into 2028, because it's going to be you and Adrian leading your firm to, you know, try to get younger Democrats to, you know, believe in like the things that were accomplished in the past, but that, you know, how could it set us up for the future, right? How could it set up the party for the future when you have new voices and, you know, new ideas and fresh perspectives really coming into the fold? So it's almost as if like you and Adrian are the conduits from the past, from a relationship building standpoint, linking fresher, newer voices in the future, and hopefully for a successful 2028 victory, whomever is on the ticket.
Absolutely. Look, I think, you know, when I think about the future of the party, I'm a glass half full guy generally, and it's hard to be a glass half full guy in many ways for the last 8 months. But you, I think there is an opportunity now that, if seized on, can really help redefine the country. And I'm also a believer that, you know, out of great crises and failure comes some of your proudest moments. And certainly from my biggest failures, I've had some of my proudest moments. And I think right now, if the Democratic Party responds appropriately with strength, conviction, message to what I believe are the atrocities of the Trump administration, we could actually help redefine the next chapter of American history. And what does that mean? Like, and people are like, what are you talking about? Well, that's what Ronald Reagan did. That is what, and this is not specific to political party. Ronald Reagan saw a challenge. Ronald Reagan inherited a country that was divided. There were economic issues, everyone knows, and tried to bring the country in his direction, which he obviously extraordinarily successfully did. And again, I'm not commenting on how anyone feels about any individual president. It's actually what Bill Clinton did. A little known governor from Arkansas, who no one really knew a couple of years before, took the country by storm and served for 8 years, again, defining the party in the country. And it's certainly what Barack Obama did. So, again, a little known senator accomplishing something a lot of people never thought we'd be able to accomplish in electing a black president and defining the next chapter of American history. And it is what Donald Trump did, love it or not, love it or hate it. And I fall squarely on one side of that. And I think that we have the ability to do that again in a big and bold way, and maybe in a way that lasts, like, say, an FDR lasted. And because, his leadership was meaningful because it was coming out of the Great Depression and people were desperate for it. And I do believe that in 2028, there is going to be a desperate, and I thought this would be true after 2020, and it obviously wasn't strong enough that we elected Joe Biden by this huge margin in 20, but that waned because, we can talk about that all day long. But I'm believing that in 2028, folks will be looking for something very new and very fresh. And I can't wait for that. And I think if we do it right with the candidates, many of whom you mentioned over the course of this, and many of whom are, I know, and or are friends of mine, I think we're going to be well served.
Of course. And yeah, it's a topic for another day. I mean, when the red wave never came in 2022 in Congress, I think that, right-wing media, they played their part in trying to concern a lot of the Biden-Harris voters of 20. And, we could talk about inflation, we could talk about, just supply chain disruption and coming out of a pandemic, and do we raise interest rates, when do we lower interest rates, and all of that. But if you look at one particular factor, I think that if President Biden was a little bit younger, then you take away the narrative of, oh, he might be getting older. And then when I think of just the fact that, unlike previous administrations or presidents where they, fade out of the limelight once their term is over, I think we just had 4 years of constant communication from Trump and his team because he was thinking that he wanted to run for a second term for reasons that you and I and many people know why he ran for a second term. But that's another, conversation for another day. But I just think that there was just a confluence of events where I think Biden, as a younger man, and when I say younger, meaning that if he would have ran in 2016 and it wasn't Hillary, but I was happy that Hillary, representing the party, I think that she was a great candidate for 2016. I think that you can factor in President Biden losing his son Beau. That was a pivotal time in their family and going through that grieving. So maybe it wasn't the right time, or one of the factors of why it wasn't the right time for, President Biden at that time being the vice president. So, again, I find it all fascinating. I had this conversation with Chuck Todd, formerly of NBC, NBC host of Meet the Press, who spent 18 years at NBC, but he's an historian like you and others, where, like me, where you look at, like, well, if one thing was different here or one thing was different there, we could have had a different election result. And but then, to your point, looking into 2028, being able to say, what do we need to do today moving forward with the candidates we know about, or potential future candidates we know about, or even new faces we're not even talking about, but who exist, right, in the country, who are, whether they're a congressman, a congresswoman, a senator, a governor, whomever, maybe someone who's coming from, again, not so much the public sector, but private sector, if he or she is looking to run. So that's what makes elections extraordinary. And I think President Obama said it best, and other people said it too, elections have consequences. And we certainly have seen that. In the last couple minutes, when did you find out you were a descendant of John Brown? And I would imagine you going to Brown University, that had something perhaps to do with it. And then I knew from a very young age, when my mom and her family had came to the United States, Armenian family, but they came from the country of Jordan at the time, and knowing all about the Andrea Doria. So when did your father tell you about that part of your life before you? And really, however those events go, I mean, because our family members survived that instance is why you and I are sitting here today, which I find pretty
That's
remarkable.
true. No, my dad and his whole family were on the Andrea Doria, and I knew that from a very early age because my grandparents were very and we also had we've I've grown up and spent a lot of my life on Nantucket, and that was the closest place And in fact, much of the Andrea Doria debris, some of which my washed up on the shores of Nantucket, and my grandparents had some of it actually at their home because they were sort of they took it when it washed ashore. They were given it when it was washed ashore. So I knew about the Andrea Doria and the photos and whatnot. I think my dad was 13 or something when the ship sank, and they were on vacation in Europe and sailed back from Europe on the Andrea Doria. I've known that most of my life. So it's one of those things that my dad, my dad's not much of a nostalgist. He's not, because my dad's mother's side of the family is very old American, and had ancestors on the Mayflower, but he doesn't like to talk about it. He likes to understand. He very much believes that who you, it's very American, right? Who you are in this world is defined by the life you create for yourself, not where your family comes from. And there's a naivete about that, but it's also a beautiful, and it's the way I try to live my life too.
Sure.
So I have to say the John Brown part, all true, is something I don't even know I knew as or I didn't it didn't have any relevance to me. My dad grew up in Providence, and my grandfather went to Brown, which is how he met my grandmother. And my grandfather was a working class guy from Kentucky who grew up in Louisville and got into Brown and met my grandmother, fell in love, and sort of started there and lived their whole life there. And it wasn't until I think later, maybe even when I was applying to Brown, that my dad said, just so you know, I'm named after his, and even my dad's name is Chad. He is named after Chad Brown, who I believe is John Brown's grandfather. So it's, it, and so, but I didn't even know that until I was, I think, applying to the university. So it's somewhat coincidental. That being said, I did have a family history at Brown. My dad didn't go there. My dad went to Princeton, but my grandfather went there. My uncle went there, and had a couple of cousins who went there. So, but I was the only one in my family who went. But it's fun. I think I don't think about it much, but I think it's a nice little anecdote is how I feel about it.
Yeah, that's so cool. Thank you so much for sharing that with me, because it's interesting, because when we were conversing, you and I and Adrian through email, and even Adrian didn't even know that, and she was like so impressed. And it's interesting because we were talking about the Andrea Doria sinking, back in July of 1956, and that was, an anniversary that, although tragic for many, it just so happened we were communicating around that time. It was my mom's birthday. She turned 73, but not only was that an anniversary for her because she had turned 4 years old right around the time of the sinking, but it wasn't until her 66th birthday, which was 7 years ago, she wanted to visit all of the Ivy League campuses and tour through them. And that's when I saw Brown University for the first time and visited 7 years ago around this time. So a lot of Julys, and although two distinct, unrelated, talking about a ship sinking to when visiting Brown University, but because both had to do with around my mom's birthday, is like it jogged my memory. But yeah, such a
Understood.
beautiful campus,
Yeah, it is.
Brown. And I have a friend from many years ago who worked there in recent years and just always talked about how much
Yeah.
she loved it. So thank you so much, Rufus, for being my 77th guest on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. I look forward to having many more conversations in the future. Thank you so much for such a candid and really informative conversation, and learned a lot. So I
Thank
wish
you, Spencer.
you all the best and look forward to staying in touch.
I appreciate so much you spending the time with me and asking these questions. So I appreciate you very much, and thank you for what you do as well. Have a great day.
Thank you too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.